Welcome to the 89th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm an endurance athlete that lives in Southwest Florida, as well as a cardiologist. I teach a nutrition class to help heal my patients from lifestyle diseases such as hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, and coronary artery disease. I also try to lead by example by doing marathons and triathlons. Currently, I am signed up for Ironman Louisville, which is going to occur in 3 weeks. So my training is coming to a peak, which entails, multiple swim, bikes, and runs. This week, my last long run was 18 miles. My last long bike was 88 miles. I've done 5,000 yards of swimming twice in the past week. My weekly runs are about 7 miles and a kind of squeeze a bike ride in there for about an hour. Could it be more? Yes, it could be more, but it's pretty much what I can squeeze in with everything else that's going on. So I don't like to make it a job. Certainly by doing triathlon, I feel that I've achieved the best condition that I have been in my life. I started out in endurance athletes doing marathons, and running is fantastic. I was somebody that didn't really cross train much unless I got injured. And I would pretty much ignore the weight training too, unless I got injured. So I got injured. So when I started doing triathlon, it forced the cross training, which I think has helped improve muscle balance. And that's really helped me. I am still intimidated by the Ironman. I guess I'd be crazy if I wasn't intimidated. I've done 3 other ones. But it's a long day. You always want to do your best. It's kind of hard to measure one against the other because some of the swims are in lakes or rivers or oceans, and the bike courses can be hilly or flat, and the weather conditions are always a factor. And then you put your training and the nutrition the day of. So it's every day, every Ironman is different with its own sets of challenges. So this time, I'm day 12 into the push-up challenge that I've been doing after my run, bike, swims. And the push-up challenge is 22 for 22 days, and that is to bring awareness for our troops that suffer from post-traumatic stress. There are 22 suicides a day in our troops. And it's a shame, it's bad enough we send our young people to war, but then when they come back and we don't support them, it's even worse. By doing 22 push-ups, does that help any? No, but it makes, maybe it brings a little bit of awareness. It brings the troops back to the forefront, that we need to respect them and to take care of them and to be empathetic towards them. And if you know someone who is returning from war, give them a little extra attention, I guess pay attention to details and see what you can do to help, to be an example or to be there for support. Doing the 22 push-ups, there's been a it's a positive thing. And I think that's always a good thing when it comes to bringing awareness to things. There's been a lot of, controversy in the news with the national anthem and certain football players not standing up. I disagree with that wholeheartedly, no matter what the reason. I'm a Go USA person all the way. I've always been a team player, always been a, underdog player as well. And I grew up in West Virginia, and we've not won too many national championships in our sports, so I've learned to root for the underdog over the years. And, I think we live in a country that, a lot of our underdogs fight and serve to help our freedoms. So we need to respect them and to support them in any way we can. And again, I think this is, the best nation in the world, despite our problems. So you always hear Go USA from me. And anything that I can do to promote or support our armed forces, I will do. Getting back to my triathlon training, though, I'm still dialing in my nutrition. It was brought to my attention that last week I said that everything was A-OK, and then I went out for a long bike ride, and I got really sleepy riding the bike. And I think that my sports drink was too concentrated. It was also brought to my attention that I could have just been tired, which that could have been too. So I guess this week I'll mix it a little bit lighter and see if I can not be as sleepy on the bike, especially in the beginning portions. It's pretty weird when you can be riding a bike and feel like you could take a nap. Certainly I wasn't close to falling asleep or anything, but it was just this fatigue of the mind more than the fatigue of the body that was interesting. I will say that on Sunday, I had a pretty much raw dinner, and I felt great on Monday during my swim, and I kind of contributed to that. We did a cauliflower, hemp seed, sunflower seed, basil, parsley, kind of rice mixture in cabbage leaves. Spring rolls with vegetables, kale, and a kale salad, and some raw ice cream. And I really felt good afterwards and had a lot of energy the next morning. So I really do think there's something to eating as much raw as you can. It is certainly more time consuming if you want to make some of the raw dishes other than just eating, making salads. So it's something that I do more on the weekend, but certainly it's easy enough to make a giant salad every day and to have raw fruits and some nuts and seeds in your diet. So I think that really helps during the week. I just finished the book that I was reading on the microbe situation. And basically that book was called The Human Superorganism by Rodney Dietert. And a couple things that were in the end of the book that I talked about last time, but I'll go over, is, the concept that, what we eat alters our gut microbe biome. And, some of the things, especially with the GMOs and the glycophosphate, which is the predominant chemical in Roundup. So it keeps the weeds from growing, but it also alters our microbiome. So if we eat vegetables that have been sprayed with Roundup, you can also have an alteration of your gut microbiome. The other thing that occurs is if you eat meat that has been given antibiotics, you're also going to alter your gut microbiome. And we know that the chickens that have been fed some of these things to help them stay healthy, including antibiotics and arsenic, they develop this gut-resistant bacteria, some of these E. coli and salmonella strains, which, again, affect our health. Even in cows, they've noted more botulism in the last several years because of a shift in their microbiome from what they've been eating because they're given this genetically modified soy and corn, most likely. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are, the great for alleviating your joint pain. People take them like candy now. I know a lot of people training that take them every day of their life, which is certainly not what they're intended for. Not only does it increase your risk of ulcers, it increases your risk of kidney disease. And certainly, if you're an endurance athlete, you want to really avoid these during your endurance race because they are associated with hyponatremia or increased water to salt ratio in your blood that can actually be deadly. You can also get more GI bleeding during an endurance event with these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. We also know that they have cardiac implications. So even the ones over the counter can cause problems with your heart, and there's increased risk of coronary artery infarctions or clotting with these things. So yeah, you have to be really careful of them. But in addition, it's been shown that these things alter your gut microbes as well. So, you know, there's more and more coming out about the gut microbes. It really feeds back to all the health of our body, whether it's neurotransmitters in the brain as far as depression and mood and cravings, or whether it's our skin and diseases of the skin, or, you know, leaky gut, or even inflammation in our organs, such as our heart. So, you know, we have to be more and more mindful about, you know, what we're choosing to eat and how we're choosing to not only feed ourselves, but to feed our microbes so that, you know, we become as healthy as we possibly can. It was brought to mind that, you know, when a drug comes out, a pharmaceutical drug, once it's given FDA approval, to take it off the market is really difficult. And to change the labeling, you know, some bad things have to happen. And we accept as a people that these things, they wouldn't be approved if they weren't safe. And that's really not the truth, especially now when a lot of pharmaceutical companies are sponsoring the research. And there's a lot of money and with scientists even being and physicians that are doing research to produce positive effects. Otherwise, they won't get asked to participate in these pharmaceutical trials. But when, you know, when people on the alternative, when, you know, we suggest a plant-based diet to people, then they're very suspicious and they want to know proof of, does it really work? And they're not going to change the way they eat unless they're sure that it really makes a difference. And why do they have to do it completely? But we accept these medications without even question. And really, to get a drug, your drug has to be proven guilty to take it off. Where, you know, in nutrition, it has to be proven that it's going to work without the shadow of a doubt, which, you know, is very difficult. In the medical literature this year, this week, I read an article discussing who should be routinely screened for heart disease, whether all diabetics should have a stress test, or certain people of a certain age should have a stress test. And you may have experienced going to see your primary care doctor and being suggested that you have a stress test. The reality is that the accuracy of a stress test is based on your risk of having disease before we do the stress test. So if you're a completely normal person that runs, you know, 20 miles without any discomfort and wins races, the likelihood of you having an abnormal stress test and significant coronary artery disease is really low without any symptoms. So to do a stress test on those people, there's a significant chance that the results could be falsely positive. So we try to only do stress tests on people that have symptoms suggestive of coronary artery disease. The coronary artery disease that causes a heart attack is typically only 20% the day before or the hours before the heart attack occurs. So he cannot be picked up on a stress test. What happens is a plaque ruptures for some reason, usually inflammation or a cholesterol crystal pokes through the plaque, and then a blood clot ensues and a heart attack occurs. There's no way to catch that with a stress test. The blockages that we catch with the stress test are typically things that have been slow occurring and blocking up over time, but are not going to cause an acute problem. If someone is having chest discomfort and we do a stress test, we can tell the area of the heart that is not getting enough blood flow. There's two ways to handle that. There is to go ahead and do intervene and see if there's a blockage and fix that particular blockage, or do nutritional alterations such as a whole food plant-based diet to see if the chest pain goes away by improving nitric oxide, and maybe repeating the stress test down the road to look for improved blood flow. The reality of it is every person in the United States does not need a stress test to see whether they have coronary artery disease, because the majority of people over the age of 50 that eat the standard American diet are going to have vascular disease. What we can offer everybody is nutritional therapy to change their plight, to improve nitric oxide production, to heal their endothelial cells so that they have improved blood flow, and that those blockages that they're starting to form never get to the point where they're really causing symptoms, and or the plaque is stabilized, so the cholesterol crystals are not going to puncture through the top of that plaque and cause the acute heart attack. That's something that we can afford as physicians to give everyone. So that a better use of our time would be to screen everyone about their nutritional history. What kind of food do they eat? How could we better change their diets? As opposed to set them up for a procedure that requires a bunch of ancillary personnel and time and radiation and the risk of false positives and going down that road of tests and interventions that aren't necessarily needed. A lot of my colleagues would say that people don't want this. They want to be screened to see if they're at risk for disease, and they want it fixed. So they want it fixed quickly with a pill. So fix my blood pressure with a pill, fix my cholesterol with a pill, and then everybody's happy and everybody goes on with their life just like it was. I really disagree with this for the most part. Since I've been doing the nutritional class and since I've been discussing nutrition with my patients in the office, both new patients and old patients, they're very interested in learning what they can do to help themselves. It's not easy to change, and it's not easy for them to get that concept, but they all are very interested in seeing what they can do to help themselves. Everybody would like to take control of their health as much as they can. It's just a different, I think people are in different positions than others. Some people are very willing and ready. Some people need to actually become aware that they are part of the problem and to actually learn to see what the problem is. I even have an 88-year-old lady in my nutrition class, and she's very interested. She's a retired nurse. We did our shopping trip this week, and she came with her notebook, and she purchased items and new vegetables. She took down notes about different recipes, and she was very interested in how she could live better. And I do believe that she can live better and improve her functional or her quality of life by eating better. Changing someone's nutrition, you know, it's not easy. It's not quick for the most part because it's so multifactorial as far as their perception of what they eat, their perception of what is healthy, and their family's perception. I had another example this week where I'm kind of at loss. I knew when I started talking to this person that I didn't agree with her perception of what was going on, but I also knew that I needed to choose what I said and how I reacted very carefully not to push her away because she really needs help. She's a very intelligent young woman who has tried numerous diets and fads and pills, not procedures yet, to lose weight. On the one hand, she really thinks that she doesn't eat anything hardly. She thinks that she eats very small portions, and yet she can't gain and she can't lose weight. She also brought up the fact that she tried to juice for a week and actually gained a pound. On the other side, as we talk further, she also mentioned that she has trouble sticking with a plan for any period of time, more than 2 weeks, if she doesn't see dramatic results. So right there, there was a disconnect, and she didn't recognize from what she said those two different statements. She feels that she exercises a lot. She's actually a physical education teacher, so I'm sure she is on the move. On the other hand, they eat out quite a bit, but she feels like she doesn't eat large portions when they eat out, and she feels as though she chooses healthy when they eat out. Again, I'm hard pressed to see anyone that can eat out 4 or 5 times a week and lose weight. So there's again another disconnect. The other disconnect was that she didn't have time and she was too tired to cook, and that was a big reason for falling off the so-called plant-based wagon often. She voiced that she had support from her husband. He is at home studying, yet she does all the cooking. And I believe she does most of the shopping. So there's at least a communications breakdown between the two of them of what is needed. The reality of it is there's not an overweight person that when you restrict calories, restrict calories more than what they burn, that they will not lose weight. It's not possible. So, you know, I know she's taking in enough calories to maintain her weight, which is a significant amount. So if I just told her to go home and follow a whole food plant-based diet and I'll see you in 3 months, it's not going to work. And she's going to say it's not going to work because nothing else has worked and this doesn't work either. So obviously there's much more that needs to be done in this particular person than just to give her nutritional guidelines. We, you know, decided on a plan of some specific things that she needs to do as far as her breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And, you know, the first thing being is to, you know, back off on going out to dinner. I talked about grocery shopping and menu planning and, you know, getting things ready, you know, and knowing what she needs to do when she, knowing what she wants to buy when she goes to the grocery store. We also talked about doing probiotics. You know, they're the gut microbes. She's had some surgeries in the past, some antibiotics in the past that certainly have contributed to probably some altered gut flora that can only be helped by probiotics. You know, whether this can change some of her cravings and, you know, detoxify her a little bit in the face of ongoing improved nutrition, I'm not sure, but it's certainly worth a chance. I talked about some, you know, community support, whether they could join the meetup group, come to nutrition class so they could talk with other people, YouTube videos, you know, different movies to watch, different books to read, so they can, and online support with, you know, vegetarian and vegan communities to help them as well. I think the more you continue to listen to podcasts and watch documentaries, connect with people on Facebook and social media, the more that you see that there is a growing movement of health through whole food plant-based nutrition and that it's more acceptable. It's hard as a physician not to win these battles. You know, I have a lot of concern with this particular person of my ability to make an impact. And if I do, it's probably going to be slow. I could be fooled. But, you know, the problem seems bigger than me in some respects. You know, I do think that there, she needs a lot of support. So I'm going to try to follow up with her on a close, you know, a fairly frequent basis and, you know, see if I can, maybe we can work together and learn and make some progress. When I turn back to my class, you know, I always kind of assess the people in the class, when they first come and over the next, you know, over the sessions, and I get a feeling for those people that are very open and want to learn everything and they're trying new things. And then there's, people that, you know, may have come maybe kicking and screaming because of their spouse or, you know, as a last ditch effort, and they're fighting the whole concept. And I also have a couple like that. The wife brought the husband to the class because he just had stents placed. And, you know, they have lived, you know, they've worked hard, they've done well, they're educated, they like to socialize, they like to golf. For the most part, they look pretty fit. You know, when you compare them to other people of their age, you wouldn't necessarily guess that he was the guy with the multiple stents and the angina. And, you know, I can see some anger there that, you know, he was a successful person in his career and worked hard. And now the fact that he has stents, he's somewhat angry about it. And he's also angry about having to change his diet or it being suggested that he change his diet. So, you know, I see him in class that he really doesn't want to be there, but his wife is kind of making him sit through the class. Then I learned, you know, a little bit more about his wife, and that I'm not so sure that she really buys into the whole thing. She actually was a diabetic educator through the YMCA and their program. And their program is basically to decrease fat consumption and exercise more, and a gentle way of portion control and modification of food intake to help control diabetes. And, you know, the YMCA, apparently their people are touting success and the grants being renewed, and but there's no metrics as far as, you know, people's diabetes certainly aren't going away. Maybe that's under control, but, obviously there's no great publications of this, a moderation being able to reverse disease. So we were walking out of the grocery store and she and another student were talking. And there was made mention that she actually had carotid artery disease and was going to have surgery. And the other person had mentioned that, about this YMCA program. And, she started talking about this program, the YMCA program, as opposed to a plant-based diet, and that the YMCA program, was a much gentler approach, but it was very, very effective. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, if that program is so effective, then, you have significant carotid artery disease that's getting worse, and your husband just had angina and four stents placed. So this is obviously not working. It's what, define what works. Again, we're so accepting that, when you get older, you get heart disease, you get high blood pressure, you get diabetes. And if you just control them, then everything will be okay. But control doesn't, that's not the answer. As far as disease progression, everything, does it slow down the progression a little bit? Perhaps, but it's still progressing at a very rapid, at a rate that's causing significant disease. It's like the smoke in the forest that, eventually it's just going to erupt into giant flames, and you don't know when it's going to erupt into giant flames. As soon as the wind is right, there it goes. So, we've had three classes, and now the pressure's on me, for the next three classes I kind of feel like I have to really, hit the ball out of the park here to get these people on board and kind of convince them. And maybe it won't be me. Maybe it's going to have to be, something else that stirs them down the line. But, again, sometimes this is just the introduction to there's a different way out there, and it's got to hit them at a different angle to make it stick. But again, as a physician and, as doing this, I want to be the one that makes the light bulb come on. So, I keep trying in different ways to, try to grab people from different ends and different disease spectrums and what we can do to reverse disease, whether it be, joint aches or diabetes or high blood pressure or get rid of a medication, success stories, and, see what can make the light bulb come on. And when we do the grocery store tour, a lot of it's about, looking at different vegetables and what recipes you could make with the various different recipes. We looked at jicama and kohlrabi, different kinds of lettuces. We looked at tofu firm and silken, and different kinds of recipes that you might use. We looked at spices, identifying ginger, fresh turmeric. A lot of people had never used. But then we also go to that aisle, with all the things that you probably should stay away from. And, we look at the labels and look how it may be packaged such that it doesn't look like there's that much salt. But when you look at the serving size, that it's actually, 500 milligrams of salt for a very small serving size. And you would use a whole lot more in that if you were cooking. We looked at the spaghetti sauces. It's always something that, surprises me as far as how much oil are in all the spaghetti sauces. It can be 30, 40% oil by calories in these sauces. So again, it starts to add up. And then we look at alternatives. You can buy tomatoes and the tomatoes that are in a box that don't have sodium and add your own spices to it. It's a better way for you to control your salt intake. And, by going through the grocery store and pointing the different things out, you can see how the sodium's going to add up throughout your day when you start to make from breakfast and lunch and dinner, how you can really get into 5, 6, 7, 8 grams of salt a day if you're not very, very careful. You know, we also looked at labels, you know, because just because it doesn't say dairy or cream on the front doesn't mean that it doesn't have whey protein, casein protein in the back, or eggs, you know, which are milk proteins that we want to stay away. We looked at, you know, some of the additives and other ingredients. A lot of things that are marked light, you know, have a lot more chemicals in them that you probably don't want to ingest. So you're better off staying away from them. In our particular grocery store, they've changed to put the bins that are buy one, get one out front. And those bins of buy one, get one are typically things that you really wouldn't want to have. You know, they put the creamy Alfredo sauces out there, and they put the high oil tomato sauces out there. They put a lot of packaged foods that have a lot of bad ingredients out there. But, it's all out there to trick people, or the marketing is, you know, maybe it's not trick, but it's to kind of get, you know, sway your attention. And before you know it, in a vulnerable period of time, you're going to pick those things up. That's why I suggest that, you know, especially people that are trying to manage, is make your menus out first and then get the ingredients at the grocery store a couple days at a time for those menued items. And, you know, when we look at marketing, you know, the chips that are in the deli and in the produce area, you know, are meant, they say vegetable, they say whole grain, they say garlic, they say, you know, flaxseed. So we think that, well, they're in that section, that they're better for us, and they're not as bad as the ones that are in the potato chip aisle. But the reality of it is they've just really been placed there, you know, in some marketing, so that they pay more to get to that. You know, it's like getting top billing. So those particular companies are paying more to get their products in a place that's going to catch your eye and maybe make you think that it's better. One other thing that's been interesting, in August 23rd of this year, the Department of Agriculture spent $20 million on 11 million pounds of cheese to buy private inventories. And their rationale was to give this surplus cheese to food banks and pantries. Apparently, there is a 30-year high surplus in milk and milk product industries. And the Congress, as well as the National Farmers Union and the American Farmers Bureau and the National Milk Producers Federation, asked the USDA to purchase these things because of the surplus. And Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack, he made a statement that's saying that we're going to take this quality protein and give to those in need. There was also an $11 million additional amount of money in government assistance to the Dairy Margins Protection Program, which is a safety net for dairy farmers. So, you know, it's touted as they're doing such a great thing. But, you know, again, cheese is one of the highest fat, highest sodium content products around. In the United States in 2015, we produced 12 million pounds of cheese, which was an all-time high. It's 29% there's been a 29% increase in the cheese production in the last 10 years. And it says that Americans consume 35 pounds of cheese each year. So think salt and fat. The average sodium intake of a 1 ounce, one slice serving is 174 milligrams. So you can get a tremendous amount of salt just by the cheese that's on a cheese sauce and the cheese that's sprinkled on your food. The cheese that's in, you know, just start looking at the cheese sticks, the cheese snacks. And there was an article published in the Woman's Health magazine that looked at cheese. And the article was basically, they started talking about, you know, there's fat and salt and cheese, but how you could do it better to be safer. But when you look at the cheeses that have the highest salt water, feta cheese, or salt content, feta cheese has one of the highest salt contents of any cheese. And that's the one that people's like, you know, I'm having the Greek salad with a little bit of feta cheese. That's healthy. You know, that feta cheese is good cheese. It has more salt than salt water, or like seawater. And the reason why there's so much salt in cheese is it stops the bacteria from growing in the cheese, and it controls the moisture content of cheese. It improves the texture of cheese. It improves the taste of cheese. Probably if cheese didn't have salt, it wouldn't taste very good. And, you know, and of course, salt is a natural preservative. It's thought that at least 8% of the salt in our diet are secondary to cheese, which is equal to a bag of potato chips. So, you know, and then that article went on to talk about, you know, ways that you could make it better by eating different kinds of cheese. And it's like, that's, of course, when I stopped, you know, I couldn't go any further. I'm not going to talk about it any further. But if you had a 1 cup of cheddar cheese, it's 532 calories with 43 grams of fat and 820 milligrams of salt. So that is a tremendous, you know, salt and fat load. On the other hand, if you start and you give up cheese and you start using a nutritional yeast, it gives things a cheesy flavor. And even if you do a cashew cheese where you're using some nuts that are soaked with the nutritional yeast and lemon juice, again, you've eliminated the salt content. Nutritional yeast is actually an inactive yeast. It's made by fermenting the sugarcane and beet molasses. It won't cause breads to rise. It's rich in B vitamins. B12, it's usually fortified with B12. Not enough to just rely on nutritional yeast for your B12, probably, but certainly the fortified nutritional yeast have B12. There's no sodium in nutritional yeast, so right then and there, you're ahead of the ball game if you use nutritional yeast as your cheese or as in things that are made to be a cheese sauce. So whether you do a cashew cheese with nutritional yeast or you do a butternut squash cheese, which is even better as far as the fat content with nutritional yeast, you're way ahead of the game. 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast has 60 calories. It has 4 grams of fiber, so regular cheese doesn't have any fiber, so you're ahead of the ball game there. It does have protein for those people that are still, you know, questioning whether they might get enough protein, which is not an issue, but it has 9 grams of protein. So it's a great alternative to make your cheeses with that. And you know, we do. We make the butternut squash cheese, and we do some cashew cheese. And we just sprinkle a nutritional yeast on things to make them little cheesies, like potatoes or, you know, some pasta with marinara sauce even. So as physicians, you know, can we leave the nutrition to other people and just kind of sit back and wait for people to get broken and heal? And that's kind of the message I heard on some of the presentations recently with the Plant Nation, that, you know, the physicians are okay to delegate this treatment to ancillary personnel. And that's great. There are certainly a lot of nutrition coaches out there. There are registered dietitians. Unfortunately, registered dietitians that work in the healthcare system don't have access to the patients often. And they don't get accessed often enough because their insurance won't allow it. So, you know, it's up to the patient to seek their advice as a consultative practice on their own. But if we look at physicians, just even waiting to people are broken, and that's typically what I see in my office for the most part as a consultative cardiologist, as I see people that are already broken. They're broken with hypertension, they're broken with diabetes, they're broken with coronary artery disease, they've had their bypass surgery or their angioplasty when they come to see me often. Times, you know, I probably get 10-15% of people, and it's increasing, but really that's about it, that come to see me that aren't broken yet, are just starting to feel the effects of standard American diet. So as doctors, we need to actually know how to use nutrition to heal people after they're broken. So I think, you know, it's not okay to say you need to eat healthy, eat mindful, go exercise. It just won't work. If I take the patient from before that is extremely overweight but can't seem to figure out what the problem is, you know, one of the things that she did say was that she doesn't have time to fix meals or prepare meals or think about it. And you know, I think that's a mindset that we have to, you know, you have to take your health back and you actually have to take the time. just like running a marathon or training for a 5K or 10K or a triathlon, you have to train for it. You just can't think, I want to do it and show up and it's going to happen. So it needs some planning. And, you know, as we've all told our children, anything worth doing is worth planning for and worth working hard for. So I think the first thing that, you know, you have to become aware is part of your problem because you just don't want to take the time to do it and you think that it's boring to cook your own meals or to plan your own nutrition, or, you know, you've just forgotten that there's, you know, you have a kitchen. So I've come up with a few suggestions to maybe help make people become a little bit more aware of their situation. I would propose people never go out just because you don't have anything in the house or prepared already, because that leads to bad choices right away. If people want to go out and socialize and have dinner out, then I think it should be a planned event, and it should be a special event, not an event just because. That way you have time to know what restaurants you're going to go to. You can peruse the menu from any website or call ahead. You know what you're going to order. If you happen to be in a situation where you're going to be with friends and you know that's not the best or the ideal location, you can eat before. So you're more mindful and in control of what you're doing. I would suggest that when you go grocery shopping, you go grocery shopping with your menu in hand. So plan out your menu that you're going to have and then go get the items that you need. If you just go mindlessly shopping, it leads to overpurchasing of vegetables that may go to waste or that you don't even know what to do with. Plan your treats or your desserts for your family. So it's not something that's just there in the junk drawer that people can grab cookies or people can grab snacks on a regular basis. Plan special time, special occasion to have sweet treats. Typically on Sunday evening, we have dessert. It's not an everyday thing. It's not something that we just go to when we don't have anything else in mind. Discuss where the food comes from with your children, especially if you're just becoming plant-based and there's some pushback from your kids. One, you know how I feel about that. It's that they don't get to vote because they're not nutritionists and they don't contribute to the grocery bill or the money for the groceries. I do think that you need to explain why you're doing, you know, you're doing the transition, but after that, you know, the ball's in your court. And again, eventually they will start to eat, the food that's provided for them. But sit down with them and discuss where the food comes from. You want dairy? You want milk? Well, this is actually where milk comes from. This is the process. And this is the reason why we don't want to have it. Also, prepare meals with your family. Get everybody involved. When they look at the preparation and see how things are going there and taste things as they're going along the way, it'll actually develop their palate. Learn, you know, they learn to eat some raw foods. I heard a comment last evening that I would eat more vegetables if, when I prepared them, they looked like my plate. And we actually met friends and family to go out to dinner last night. And I picked the restaurant knowing that the rest, three out of the five people were not plant-based. But I made sure that there was actually an entree there for me. And it happened to be a cauliflower, roasted cauliflower, and a farro salad with corn and tomatoes and peppers and broccolini. And it was delicious. And when my plate came out, it was, you know, again, usually you have this big pile of vegetables and everybody's like, oh, that really looks good. And that was when the comment came, if my vegetables look that good, then I would prepare more. Well, when they come out of the garden, they look that good. And when they come from home, from the produce aisle, they look good. So it's a matter of keeping them looking good. And, you know, even if you experiment with some raw foods, you learn the tastes of them and, you know, just lightly steaming things, you go from there. A little pepper and lemon juice goes a long way if you don't know what to do with something. I'm not a huge fan of the batch cooking. I don't think it will last. I think that somebody that doesn't like to cook, that's going to become old really quick and they're going to start doing that. So that leads to falling off the proverbial plant-based wagon. I also have heard from people that when they make a whole bunch of stuff that they don't want it. You know, they go to the freezer and it's like, well, that doesn't seem that appealing to them. So I think, you know, I'm in more of in favor of planning your meals and then going shopping for those groceries, you know, 2 or 3 days at a time or a week at a time if you can do the menus. You know, if you find something that you like, write it down. You know, we have, I guess one night a week is going to either be burrito or pizza night. Pretty much always happens. So it kind of alternates whether it's Pizza Friday or Burrito Friday. So that's one day down. We always have at least one day that's soup. So we have a soup, and there's probably one day that's a casserole. And, you know, we might eat that casserole 2 days in a row if it's leftover. And, you know, there's one day that's pretty simple, and it's like sweet potato, greens, and beans. So that's simple. So, you know, I've knocked out 4 or 5 days really quick that I don't have to think about it. What kind of soup do you want? You know, Wednesday soup. So which, you know, make a soup. That Thursday with the sweet potato and the greens, all you need to know is what kind of greens you're going to have. Are you going to have broccoli? Are you going to have Swiss chard? You know, and do you want butter beans or Great Northern beans? And you're going to have your sweet potatoes. So it's a mindless. So it could be mindless Thursday and soup Wednesday and burrito Friday. So you got 3 days already down. I do always prepare a little bit extra when it comes to rice and beans and beets. So I'll make, you know, more beans than I expect to eat on burrito night. Or more beans than I need for the bean soup, perhaps, so that I have them for the rest of the week for my lunch. Same way with rice. I'll double the rice when I make it, so then I have leftovers for lunch or something else. So, you know, that makes it easy. You know, I like to eat beets. I suggest people eat beets. They're a good source of nitric oxide. So I'll roast 5 or 6 beets at once and keep them in the refrigerator. And I can pull them out if I want to put vinegar on them, or I want to heat them up, or when I put them on a salad, then they're ready to go. Stock your pantry with staples that you use on a regular basis. So beans, rice, quinoa, oats. Have potatoes, onions, and garlic on hand. Spices such as, you know, black pepper, red pepper, paprika, ginger, cumin, turmeric. Those are things that I use on a frequent basis. So I have that available. You know, I think it would be pretty easy to teach kids that, you know, for dessert, there's the option of a fruit smoothie. So if you have bananas and blueberries around, then you have the option of that. If you have some cacao powder, it could be a chocolate banana smoothie. So you limit the size to a glass. It's very filling, and you don't have to worry about it not being nutritious, and you don't have to worry about them getting a lot of sugar and fat. Keep in mind that, you know, you're developing your child's taste buds and you're developing your child's gut microbes. So, you know, always keep that in mind. If you're feeding them sugar, fat, and chicken nuggets, you are selecting for those the kids to become, you know, have microbes that are going to lead to illness and a variety of other things. So that's kind of motivation to keep people you know, focus on the microbes. And there's emerging data as far as attention deficit disorder that kids do much better with a plant-based vegetable diet. Get rid of the additives, get rid of the sugars, get rid of the fat, get rid of the salt. So, you know, you're doing more than one thing when you try to cook healthy for your family. I think that'll pretty much wrap it up this week. We do have a location for our day-long nutrition conference. It is going to be at Twin Owl Country Club in Punta Gorda, Florida. It's a great location. Dr. Clapper will be there. We're hoping to have some other guests. So keep up with the website. You know, when we'll start putting tickets out, probably not until December, but you know, there's 200 seats available for that, and I promise it'll be a good day with breakfast and lunch, and we'll go from there. If you're local, I have my nutrition classes. There's every week for an hour and a half, and they're nice group sessions at our local Chamber of Commerce in a nice laid-back setting. So look at the website for that. Do check out the website at drdelaney.com. You can email me with questions, suggestions, jamiedulaney at gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney at gmail.com. Don't forget, I usually post what I eat on Instagram if you're looking for menu ideas. Again, during the week, everything is usually pretty simple for me, and my lunches are certainly very simple because I come home and make them right then and turn around within the hour. So I look forward to seeing you next week, and to your health, and get some exercise. Eat your veggies.